Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Prep Talk podcast hosted by myself, Pete Flips, and Nick Spizak. Today, we have a very special guest, Dylan Carter. We are very, very happy to have him. Dylan is a staple of the Amazon community, originally known for his knowledge of the wholesale space, but now he is more known in the software area, specifically in repricing. He's a co-founder of Aura, and he has created a tremendous reputation for himself, offering tons of value to the community with a deep, deep knowledge of repricing and offering a perspective that can help both the beginner and the advanced seller. So Dylan, thank you for hopping on. We're very, very happy to have you.
Yeah, thanks for you guys having me on, man. I'm pumped.
Absolutely. So what we're looking to do at the very beginning is kind of paint the backstory in a little bit more depth. And then we'll kind of just go where the conversation goes.
Nice. Yeah. So I got started, a little over a decade ago. So I spent a third of my life in the Amazon seller space and either as a seller or on the software side, which is like crazy now. I feel like I'm finally getting old. So at the time I was, I graduated high school, took a few years off trying to figure out what I wanted to do, knew I wanted to go into entrepreneurship, but didn't know what that really meant at the time. Cause growing up in at least my area of Florida, that's not really common. Especially the way I wanted to do it. I wanted like the location independent things, you know, the 4-hour work week by Tim Ferriss had recently come out. So my brain's buzzing with all these things and got really heavy into working out at a gym. It was recommended that I go get nationally certified. I was like, you know what, why not? Let's do it. So I got nationally certified through NASM and started doing that full time to pay the bills, all the good stuff while I was trying to figure out what I was doing. I tried, you know, starting like a dropshipping course, blogging, all the things. And eventually heard about selling on Amazon via Pat Flynn's podcast, Smart Passive Income. I think they were the Selling Family back then. They're still kind of around, at least the site is. But I kind of went through the general journey that everybody goes through, right? You hear about this thing. You're like, oh, that sounds interesting. Is it real? You go scan a few things at Target or Walmart. You flip it. You get the proceeds back in your bank account. You're like, oh, cool. This is real. What do I need to do, right? And like for me, it's always a journey of forks in the road, right? And I think you will constantly in your life have these forks, these kind of choices you have to make, right? And so for me at the time, I was not sitting very well with the general manager at the gym. I had found a unique kind of method for getting clients and all these things, and we just didn't see eye to eye on certain things. And so I eventually left the gym and had all my clients, which was really tough because I found a niche where I was helping middle school and high school kids dealing with basically like self-esteem issues, whether that was body image, anything like that, confidence. And so I really loved what I did, got a lot of fulfillment, but to make more money and to scale, I either had to charge their parents more money, which felt kind of weird, or just work more hours. And so at that point, I was waking up at 4 a.m. to do a 5 a.m. boot camp. I would eat for an hour and then basically train clients until 9 p.m. at night and then like try to train myself. And that was just really tough. That was like just not really sustainable at all. That's when I got into nootropics because I couldn't sleep. So thanks ephedrine and Diet Coke. But then I kind of looked at the GM who had taught me these things. It was like, oh, you're addicted to that. That's probably not a good path to go down. So anyways, I could have bought a gym. There's a gym for sale for like $100,000 locally. I love that concept of like owning the gym. And I just realized, well, one, I don't have any money at that point. So like, I'm not going to buy a gym. And two, I don't really want to do like at-home training or anything like that. But I had already started to test the waters with Amazon on the weekends. And so I made a clear decision to tell my clients, love you, but like, this is not my path anymore. For me, it always comes back to scale, right? How do I scale? And so, you know, you start with your time and making as much as you can per hour. That hits its limits. And then you go to physical products in a lot of cases, especially back then, that was all the hype, right? And so I'm like, cool, I can get sales while I'm asleep. That's more scalable. And I did that and I grinded like crazy doing RA, would pack out my truck every day. But I decided to go back to school full time as a finance major. Funny enough, I know a lot of people are like anti college. I'm not. I think it kind of depends. I think it's a more nuanced approach. For me, I actually learned a ton and loved what I did. I kind of thought at the time, though, that I wanted to go into like investment banking or private equity because I love that kind of world. Hate accounting, corporate finance, so boring. But like massive deals sounds so cool, right? Leverage buyouts, all these things sounds awesome. But I got to a point where I again didn't have time, right? So I'm going to school full time. I'm in classes. I want to be in classes. I want to be emerged. And I kind of had to choose how do I scale further because RA wouldn't work. So I tried online arbitrage, which it's so funny now because I feel like it's so much easier. Not that it is easy because there's so much more tooling available than when I tried to do it like 10 years ago. like you were just flying blind barely with Keepa, and Keepa data was still good, but like only so good. You know what I mean? Like you were still making a lot of bad decisions. I sucked at OA. I'll be completely honest. I was horrible at it. And so I was like, all right, well, I have to make the next fork in the road here. It's either wholesale or private label. Well, wholesale is really good for cash flow. Horrible to sell later. Like you're not going to get a good multiple when you go to sell that company if you can, but private label is really good for a big exit down the line, but you're not going to pay yourself for 6 months, maybe 12. So I'm like, cool. Wholesale it is. Let's figure that out. But funny enough, at the time, there was no real education that was widely accessible for wholesale. That was still considered like big dog kind of stuff, right? Like you needed tens of thousands of dollars, maybe $100,000 to get started. That was these assumptions. There was only one group that was teaching it, but it cost thousands of dollars in the course to learn. And at the time, I was like, man, that's like $2,000 I could put towards inventory, you know? Like I got to figure this out. And so although I was paying my bills with RA, said I'm not allowed to buy inventory unless it's wholesale. Like I'm just going to have to deal with it. Like I'm just going to have to put my back in a corner and figure this crap out. Eventually did figure it out after 3 to 4 months of just kind of struggling and realized, oh wait, this is just sales. And I did sales when I was a personal trainer. We actually did like role playing, like all these things, like handling objections. I was like, wait a second. That's just that skill set. Everybody's like, here's the tactics. I'm like, but what you're not saying is what is really happening here, which is just go read like 3 to 5 sales books and you'll crush this.
Right.
And then it started to take off. And that was great. And then started DMing everyone on Instagram that had a seemingly larger wholesale business than I did. Nobody responded except for my now co-founder, James, who said, hey, don't worry about the money. Cause I was offering, you know, hey, I'll give you $100 for an hour, whatever back then. And he's like, dude, don't worry about the money. I love talking about this. Nobody here does this. Let's just geek out. And so we jumped on Skype. That's how old I am now. We jump on like once a week and we would just geek out, you know, kind of mastermind. And eventually he's like, hey, I'm a computer science major. Cause we started talking about personal life. You know, I was in college, he's in college. And we realized we had designed the same kind of internal logistics like process, you know, using Trello for managing our shipments, different stages, all these different things, spreadsheets. And he's like, yeah, I kind of just built like a web app of that. I was like, oh, that's kind of cool. He's like, hey, do you want to partner on this? Cause I don't know any of the front facing stuff. I'm an engineer. I'm like, yeah, I also didn't know any of the front facing stuff at the time. So we partnered up and we launched VinDrive CRM, made all the mistakes because we had no idea what the hell we were doing, which was really fun because we had the sandbox where we could learn with like real people, you know, real users. And so we took that learning and said, okay, well, this isn't really going to scale up to be a big business, which is kind of what we want here. What have we learned here? Well, we learned how to do all the wrong things. So let's take the inverse here. Let's apply that because we had been working on it for like a year. Let's apply that forward. You know, we built up this audience. We started the first wholesale based podcast called Wholesale Made Easy. We had started the first wholesale focus Facebook group, got it to 15,000 people. We live sourced for like 2 hours every Tuesday for 2.5 years. God, that's a lot of twos. but this is what we did, right? We just gave out tons of stuff because we wanted to build this audience. And we personally didn't want to launch courses. So we said, while everybody's launching courses as the business, we'll give that away for free and launch software on top of it. And we paused and said, well, what area could we go into that would get us really excited to work on? That's a really hard technical challenge that we think we could actually have a positive impact on. And that happened to be repricing, because a lot of tools are really complex and cumbersome to understand and use. I've been a seller and we've used these other tools, and I put off repricing for years, which is so ironic because now I run a repricing company, right? Where I'm just like, no, it's like overwhelming. You can screw it up. There's all these horror stories. And funny enough, having ran one for so many years, you realize all the advice that was being given, especially back then, it's changed a little bit. Luckily, I think we've hopefully helped with this narrative, but a lot of what was given was just completely false. And you start to look at your data set as a repricing software company and be like, well, hold on. Everybody's saying go this route, but the data's saying something completely different. We got to talk about this. And so, you know, we did that. I eventually shut down the Amazon business again, another fork in the road where I'm in my senior year. I had met my now wife. Companies taking off. And I'm like, you know what? I got to shut something down here. And I actually made the decision to shut down my profitable Amazon business to go full on with software. And it's, you know, definitely one of the best decisions I've ever made.
Dylan, you just went through a whole bunch that we will need to unpack, because there's
like
a
decade.
There's a lot of good content in here that I think the listeners will appreciate. One observation I want to hit on for anyone that's listening that hasn't gone through the Wholesale Made Easy podcast, timeless asset right there. That was one of the items where I actually met you first through content, was going through step by step the Wholesale Made Easy podcast. So if anyone's listening and they haven't gone through it, it's still incredibly relevant to the current environment and the way that you have it all structured and the guests that came on there. So kudos to you, just kind of how you structured things and how you communicate these different topics. Now,
yeah, I appreciate that. We, you know, just to riff on that for a sec, we've left it up, right? We don't produce it anymore because when we set out to produce it, one, I just thought it'd be a cool thing to have a podcast. And fun hack, by the way, if you want to talk to people that would never, you know, respond to your emails, start a podcast. I got Mike Michalowicz, like Profit First guy, to come on. Emailed him out of the blue. He's like, yeah, sounds good. Next Tuesday work. I was like, yeah. So, you know, it was a good hack, but I realized when we started this was like, again, the education doesn't really exist, but I wanted to provide evergreen content and not the tactical things that are going to change. I wanted it to last on its own. And so I think we got to like 54-ish episodes. And I remember waking up one day and being like, we're good. That's it. I'm starting to push into tactics and I don't want to do that because it's going to change. There it is. That's the whole thing. And we're going to let it ride. I remember being in Miami Seller Conference recently and had a few people come up and be like, yeah, dude, I recommend it all the time. I was like, that's so crazy because I haven't touched it in like 4 years and it's still relevant, which is really cool. So I appreciate that.
And just the way that you think about it, right? So we hear in the timeline, you'll see at different things, the common advice is to set up SOPs, standard operating procedures and systems. Can you talk a little bit, like, what does that actually mean from your lens? Like, what is a standard operating procedure? What is a system? Because if it's the first time you're coming in as a new Amazon seller, a new business owner, and you're hearing these terms come around, like, what are some of the items that they should be thinking about when they hear the term SOP or setting up a system?
Yeah, I almost got to a point where I hate the term SOP because it's so... it's almost overutilized, but still completely misunderstood. It's a checklist. That's all an SOP is. It's a checklist. It's literally, if you say, here, I source, I go, great, how? Write it down. Tell me the exact steps you do it. Is it a repeatable system or do you sit down and just kind of, you know, figure it out in real time? Are you recreating the wheel every single time? So a good example of this, my first wholesale order, I completely botched, like lost $2,000 on it. I was like, oh, cool. Made a mistake. Let's learn from that. And so I reviewed and reanalyze that SKU and said, okay, I'm going to view this from fresh eyes. And I realized I was looking for reasons to buy something, not for reasons not to buy it. So I wasn't actually looking for the red flags. I was looking for, you know, just reasons to feel good about it, which doesn't really work, especially when you're new. And so I said, well, let me review it from a different perspective, completely flip the switch here. And as I was going through it, I found all the things and I wrote them down. And I said, okay, cool. What if I build a checklist? So every time I do get burned, because you're going to learn, you're supposed to fail, right? That's how this works. But failing forward really means learning from the mistakes. Well, how do you technically learn from the mistakes? Yeah, sure, you can remember it and all that good stuff. But the reality is, unless it's the most painful experience you ever went through, you're probably not really going to remember it, right? We encode memories to emotional states, right? Really, really horrible, traumatic, you're going to remember the hell out of it. Not that big of a deal, you're going to forget. Okay, cool. So what if every time I analyze a SKU, I went through this checklist? Well, if I made a mistake and I baked that mistake into my checklist, I'm going to find it next time and avoid it moving forward. So I only make a mistake once. Mm-hmm. Eventually you get to a point where you're like, oh, there's only like six things here. If I just, you know, go through and check for these six things, I'm probably going to be okay. Now I'm doing this for myself, right? Not for VAs. This is so important. You create checklists, SOPs, processes, whatever you want to call them, for yourself first. Why? It speeds you up. You're still a human. You're not perfect. You're not special. That's why why internally James and I use the term founder, not business owner, because there's a lot of like identity language that matters here. And a lot of business owners think they're special and they're the genius in the company. You're not. You should be the dumbest one in your company, period. If you're not hiring people smarter than you, what are you doing? Right. And so, and I don't care where they live. I don't care how much you pay them, but like they should be highly intelligent people. And so we did this also with support, right? When we first started Aura, I did support for the first two and a half years full-time as one of the founders. And I remember having an advisor, a big name in our space, say, that's a dumb move. It's not scalable. It's not worth your time. Your time's worth dramatically more as a founder. I said, no, this is the best place for me to be because the feedback I'm going to get by talking to clients, talking to users every single day is going to make the difference. And I don't even know how to build a support team. I can't just be like, go do support. I don't even know how to define that. What does that even mean? And I talked about this in office hours today. where a lot of people outsource too early, right? They outsource sourcing to VAs, but you don't even understand what you're doing. Well, how's that work, right? Yeah, if you can outsource PPC to a PPC specialist, that's completely fine because that's something they've been doing for like 3 to 4 years. That they have that skill set. They can come and own that and crush it. But when you need to bring somebody in that you have to teach them how to do things, you set the standard. And so for us, one of the biggest pillars was we have amazing world-class customer support and success, period. We don't outsource it. It's amazing. Well, how do I even know what the heck that means? How do I measure that? I got to figure that out, right? I had to figure out what even the KPIs were. What are the metrics? How do I even tell my team, here's how we measure success here? I've never done it. So I'm going to go do it. And so I built this checklist as I learned. And then what's great is when we hired Finn, who was our first CSM or customer success manager, I said, hey, just watch me for a week. Literally, I would jump into Zoom. That's all he would do. He'd watch me. I'd explain what I'm doing, walk through the SOPs. We had so much support documentation that nobody else in the company had seen except for me. And so what's nice is I don't go, hey, man, watch me do it. So you kind of get a flow. You get to understand how I'm thinking. He goes, well, how do I do X? Notion doc. How to do Y? Notion doc. And I literally had a doc that said, if you can't find an answer here, now come tell me because it should be here. And so I was like, one of our checklists, one of our rules is you're not allowed to come to Dylan with a question unless you've already searched Notion. And if you can't find the answer in Notion, now you come to Dylan and I should actually write the support documentation and give you the answer. So checklists sound so rudimentary, but at the same time, these are the things that allow you to scale and move faster. It's how you reduce the number of mistakes you're going to make and how you're able to say, cool, I've really fleshed out how we do this, whether that's sourcing, placing restock orders, it doesn't matter. Now go hire somebody to hand that over. What a lot of people do is they try to hire for effectiveness, which again, if you're hiring a PPC specialist, totally, yeah, nothing wrong with that. But when you're hiring a VA to help you source, you're not hiring for effectiveness. You're actually hiring for efficiency.
Yep.
And so if you haven't figured out how to be effective as a sourcing person first, and you go to hand over that process to someone else, they become efficiently ineffective. Doesn't work. But what happens when you make the entire process perfectly optimized, effective as hell, and ideally already efficient, now you hand it over. Yeah, go hand it over to 2-3 VAs to help you source. So it's one of those things that it sounds so MBA and cool. It's just a checklist most of the time. It's like literally, just check these 5 things and you're good. Okay, cool. Other times it's, hey, step one, you got to do this. Step two, you got to do this. We do weekly office hours every Wednesday from 2 to 3 p.m. EST. There's a checklist for how to do that. Now, I do all of it, but if I can't make it, I'm like, oh, crap, my team needs to help me get set up because I'm running late. I go, hey, check the Notion doc. Can you set that up for me? Yeah, done. Easy.
100%. One thing that I really wanted to pull out, obviously the passion that goes into what you do. You can feel it, right? But one thing I wanted to pull out there, you were kind of talking about how you really focused on understanding the customer support and then transferring that. And you kind of do it on the fly, which is a normal like founder thing. You have to figure it out before you can have someone do it, right? What I've seen differently from you and your team, not only the passion, but then reaching the community at the ground level. Like you're offering people rides at Miami Seller Conference, hosting community hours. Can you touch a little bit on what goes into that thought process and how you approach supporting your customers in general?
Yeah. It does come back to why the heck does the company exist? I think this does matter, right? I remember I speak at a few events and I went to a retreat and it somehow came about where there was this weird trend where I would get pulled away with one person. They'd be like, just analyze my whole life. I was like, all right, cool. I was like, I think I might be a sociopath, but it was a positive thing. Right. And they're like, cool. I'm like, what do you want out of life? Like, what the heck's the point? And there was so many people, like there's like 25% of the people that I talked to that were like, I'm doing this business to do this other thing. Like, but why not just do the other thing? That's what you really are getting fired up about. What the hell are you even here? Why do you care about Amazon if you want to go start a design agency? Just go do that. And so like my whole thing is you can make money doing a lot of different things. You can make a lot of money being a drug dealer, but nobody's really that excited to do that, right? So at the end of the day, it's not about the money. Although don't get me wrong, I'm a capitalist, I'm a founder all day long. Love it. But the thing that's going to wake you up when crap's just hard. And by the way, what we do is just really difficult in a lot of cases. You have to have a reason behind it. And so when James and I set out, we said, you know, we graduated college, the business was doing okay. We're like, well, what do we want to do here? Is this just like a lifestyle business? We can just enjoy it and have free time. We're like, no, screw that, dude. Let's build something amazing here. Let's see what we're capable of. And we sat down, we said, we're going to commit 10 years to this at minimum. That's what it's probably going to take to build. We've never done this before. We're completely new. So we're like, we don't know what we're doing. We're going to have to commit tons of time, tons of patience to this. We're going to learn a ton. And at the end of the day, why do you do what you do? For us, it's serving sellers. It's not even being, I can be a little selfish with it too, right? Like if I help you make an amazing product and get you pumped up, you're going to talk about it and other people are going to come and pay me money. So it works out, right? But like at the end of the day, I really love getting feedback. We have we use Slack internally. We have a success channel in there where we just post amazing feedback we get, and it's daily, you know? And it just gets me pumped up to see somebody join us, hear me talk about it, and then go and experience it and then give me feedback and be like, oh crap, you were serious. Yes, I absolutely love what the hell we do. And so there is a level of passion behind it, but it comes down to honestly wanting to have an impact. I've been in this industry so long and I have experienced so many crappy companies and crappy people that, to be honest, I'm over it. I'm really just frustrated and I'm over it. And we as a company, me as an individual, I want to set a better standard. I want to set a better standard for what software should be in the Amazon seller space. Because honestly, most of it's not that good. And that's really frustrating because our sellers, our industry deserves better. I'm over the shady kind of gurus that come in that don't really know what they're doing. Our industry deserves better. And I had Amazon sellers at my wedding. You know what I mean? Like that's my whole life. And so I deeply care about these people. And it's hard not to get jazzed up, to be honest, with what we do when you hear people be like, yeah, dude, I just quit my job. This was a hobby and now I can go full time because of like what you guys built. Like, how do you not get excited? You know what I mean? And so, yeah, there is a lot of passion, but it does come down to the why behind it. And for me, it's impact. I want to impact a ton of people. It gets me pumped. Yeah.
Well, and one thing so just for context for the audience, I recently switched over to Aura, been very happy with it. But so the one thing that really stuck out to me out of all the features that you guys have is the exposed backlog where the community upvotes it. Can you talk? Yeah. I thought that was like crazy because you're giving you're giving buy-in to your consumer, which is amazing and influence, right? Can you talk about what went into that? Because I ate that up. I thought it was so cool.
No, that's great. So feedback.goora.com. Any user can go vote, add a comment, downvote things, add their own ideas. We review this every Thursday. So we're actually going to look at this tomorrow as a team. Every Thursday we sit down, we go through this, we stack rank it and say, great, what do users really care the most about? And what do we think has the most impact? So we try to find this balance. What's so funny about what we do, we take best practices from the tech world. That's what's so funny, right? This is not a 0-to-1 stuff. In the world of tech, this is not like unheard of stuff. We use a software company that's designed to do this. But what's so interesting, and this is kind of goes back to my comment about like wholesale is just sales. If you can understand the game you're playing, you can go find the industry that's already matured, that has already answered a lot of your questions and take the best practices and apply it here. So a lot of the Amazon software space doesn't do that. They take this weird, interesting approach where it's like outsource everything and like, support is like a cost center and all these different things. Well, not really, like what if we just go view? And again, language here matters, right? We call ourselves founders, not business owners. We call ourselves a startup, not a software company necessarily. Well, why? Well, because how you identify yourself is the content you're going to consume and the decisions you're going to make. And so by identifying our company and saying we're a startup first, who are we comparing ourselves to? It's not other Amazon software companies, it's tech startups. And so by looking that way, our reference point is very different than our competition because they're just looking at one another. And we go, yeah, you should do that to a certain degree. But what happens when you care really deeply about your users and give them a way to communicate directly with you, whether that's the roadmap, email, like I give out my email personally all the time. dylan@goor.com, D-I-L-L-O-N. Like, email me. Like, I'm dead serious. Email me. You know what I mean? Like, that support, like, all that qualitative feedback comes back to us. And we're looking at comparing ourselves to the tools we use and love. So I'm not looking at our competition and be like, is our product better than them? I'm looking at startups. I'm looking at people who just raised $10 million, $20 million, $100 million. Be like, not are we better than them as a product necessarily because they're not repricing tools, but from like a quality of software standpoint, what are the best practices that are growing and establishing there that we should adopt? That's what I want to go look at. How, what are our hiring practices? You know, like, we hire very differently. Like, we don't just, you know, find the cheapest person in the Ukraine or in India to hire for, like, we don't hire developers. We hire software engineers. And Nick can speak to this. That's a very different person. Like, we hire legit software engineers. These are six-figure people. And so by shifting our language, we're able to make different decisions and honestly just operate differently. And so, yeah, we do operate very, very differently. And I'm very proud of that. But some of that also comes down to first principles. What do you want to achieve? What's the ideal outcome here? Define it. Great. Go figure out how to do that. So like, for support, we had everybody under the moon telling us, hey, you're going to have, like, to scale this up to thousands and thousands of users, you're going to need like 10 something support staff. No. I told them flat out, I was like, based on my calculations, we should be able to have one person handle 2,500 users without crying at night. We've right. outgrown that. Like, you know what I mean? Like, you like, but there's all these assumptions, this non-first principles kind of philosophy, which is like, well, I've never seen that done. Okay. But have you ever attempted to solve that problem? Well, no, this is just what I've seen. Okay. Then get out of the way. Let me figure it out. Maybe I'm wrong. Sure. But let's figure out if I'm right or not. Right. And you're going to be wrong a lot, but you could be right a lot too. And so it's just really interesting. Like, a lot of our competition can't fathom how small of a team we are. Like, we're six people going on seven hiring another software engineer. And most of our competitors publicly think that we outsource everything. Like, no, nothing actually. Like, nothing. Like, we worked with vendors for like paid acquisition, like Google Ads and like agencies, but even that's all in-house now with one person, you know? So like, again, you just have to think differently.
Well,
I want to go into a question around culture for a second here. So
yeah.
You touched on this a lot, and it's come out as we've had the dialogue. So hiring software engineers sitting in that seat are naturally curious and will look to the next type of tool, their next type of shiny item there. So as a founder of a software company that hires software engineers, can you talk a little bit about the balance of capabilities and how you tie them back to your core mission for giving your customer base value? So I think that's a dynamic that most probably would resonate with on the value side, but may not see, like, how do you do that as a founder? What are some of the things that you've learned in your journey?
It's actually really hard. It is hard to find a really talented software engineer that's also product minded and customer centric, because most of your engineers are going to go into big orgs, go to Fang, whatever, you know, Facebook, Amazon, Apple, all that, where they don't have to really care. They never actually get to see the end consumer. They're just told build this ticket and then go and build that thing. For us, it's so different. Like, you have direct contact with users. And, you know, in our last hiring round, I think we looked at 200 applicants and had three come into the office for a second round, 10 for a first round. Because there's a few where I'm like, yeah, you're incredibly talented as a software engineer. Like, technically, you're great. But the decisions you're making are not at all remotely factoring in our users or what they think, or, you know what I mean? Like, being product minded. And so that is hard. It's actually what we look for as a unicorn, which is really tough, right? We're looking for somebody who's product minded, who's customer centric, who's a self-starter, who can deal with autonomy. And those are really hard things to find in a software engineer. And so there's so many different archetypes of engineers. And so from a culture perspective, how do you do that? I think you have to hire for it first. And so even if somebody hasn't done it before, but they have that innate curiosity about solving problems, I think they're going to be okay. There is a problem where if you over-index on that one thing, you can find somebody who is really good at solving problems, but not really good at defining the importance of a problem. They just like to knock out tickets, right? There's like, solve it, solve it, solve it. It's like, okay, pause. What are we doing here? Right? How do we prioritize? How do we understand these things? And so for us, being able to at the team. So on Thursdays, we have what's called an all hands. So we do daily standups. It's like 10, 15 minutes. What's everybody working on? But on Thursdays, it's different. We sit down as a team. We review all the company metrics, completely transparent. Everybody knows revenue, profitability, everything. Churn, all of it. We review it. Everybody owns their own KPIs. Part of that is also viewing our customer feedback. So we have our own ideas, certainly, but we want to look at customer feedback and understand, why does this matter? And you can't just scoff at it and be like, oh, it's not important. User said it's important. Doesn't matter what we think. We have to find that balance. Certainly, it's not binary. But that is really hard. And I think, you know, for us, that's why it's taking a little bit longer than we would love to hire an amazing engineer, because a lot of layoffs occurred recently. And so naturally you think, cool, like the market's in our favor. No, because actually the bottom 10% got laid off. You're like, oh, crap. Like, yeah, that's not how that works. And so for a lot of times, it may feel like we're going slower as a company, because like we're hiring slower. Like technically, it would be dramatically easier for us to hire remotely and contract it out. It would, but that's not the right decision in the long term. Like for us, it's always long-term play, right? I love the whole play infinite games with infinite people, right? I'm not making short-term decisions here. And because we're bootstrapped, we didn't raise money, we don't have a board of directors, we can kind of make whatever decisions we want, including if that means we're going to go a little bit slower to find the right person here. Yeah, that's fine. Because one software engineer can outdo 10 developers all day long. And I've seen it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 100%. I think that something that I see, like from your group specifically, mm-hmm. we've touched on a little bit, but like when you have a small group of people that are maniacally focused on their consumer, which yeah. from a corporate background, you do not see, like it is not, right. it is actually criminal how yeah. far like a service provider can get from their customer, and they'll just have yes. these kind of bullshit conversations all day and just churn over themselves. So I just want to mm-hmm. give kudos to your group there. Like you've knocked it out yeah. of the park. But kind of pivoting a little bit, just getting into like maybe a little deeper repricing for the audience.
Sure.
We'll start kind of vague in that. What, in your opinion, are some like misconceptions about the repricer space? And then how are you guys doing things like differently, I suppose?
Yeah, it's good. A lot of the misconceptions are that it just reprices down. It can be the case, but that's not by default what we do. Although some tools do that, unfortunately. I think a lot of the misconceptions are changing, because some of them used to be true, right? The misconception was it's very complex, overwhelming, and like you can really screw it up. Yeah, that was true. For us though, how are we different? Like we already talked about the company. I always talk about the people in the company before the product. When people are like, how are you different than your competition? Well, people first and foremost, like straight up. And it feels like a cop out, but like, no, go test us. Like, I promise you it'll feel different. On the product side though, you know, we legitimately rebuilt. We took like 18 months to completely rebuild the software from the ground up, like whole new language, like re-architected, like ground up every line of code, like really painful. Don't recommend it. But it actually was a blessing in disguise, because the old API was getting deprecated, meaning they were going to turn it off. So data was going to stop flowing, and they're pushing everybody to the new API. Well, that's cool. What did every software, you know, company do? Well, they just swap out the endpoints, because it's the least amount of work. You don't introduce more complexities, things you're not really comfortable with. So we did that on legacy, but we were re-architecting 1.0, the new version. So we paused for a few weeks and said, let's go through the support documentation here for the API and see what's really possible. And we came out with something really cool called Hyperdrive. And so, you know, before we get to that though, we had to take a step back and say, well, first principles, if we were to build Aura knowing what we knew today, would it be the same? Well, no, so many different decisions. And so we decided to make those changes, right? And so we had to clarify, what are the problems sellers are dealing with? It's not just make a better repricing tool. That's so linear, right? Like I can make something 10% better all day long. That doesn't really have an impact. That doesn't really get me excited or the team excited, to be honest. You know, for us, it's like, how do we create something fundamentally different in how we're thinking about solving this problem? And so for us, we said, well, the problem really comes down to two things. It's complexity and speed, right? You need to handle far more variables far faster. Well, that's actually a great case for software. So that works out. And you actually kind of subdivide these into our main features, which is like Maven for complexity and Hyperdrive for speed, which actually works out really nicely. Speed, I'll cover that because it's honestly the easiest to explain conceptually. We found a way. So basically, when we say we have instant repricing, we've always had instant. I think if you're getting anything less than instant, you're just wasting your money. But instant doesn't technically mean instant. It really means 1.5 to 2 minutes on average, because when we instantly respond to a price change, that is instant. But when we submit it to Amazon and wait for it to come back to be confirmed, reflected, approved, all that stuff is 1.5 to 2 minutes on average. So welcome to marketing. We love to take things and make it sound crazier than it is. Technically, it's true. But we have to give context here, because we found something that's faster than instant, which is like, okay, how do you do that? That's why I have to give the context. So instead of doing that 1.5 to 2 minutes, we found for up to 50 of your SKUs, there's a technical limit there. We can do that round trip in less than 10 seconds. So we're talking a theoretical 12x increase in speed at peak, right? Assuming you need that. Okay, cool. That works. And you know how you deal with it? It's a toggle. That's it. Like, I love taking these crazy complex technical things and just making it so simple and dummy proof for users, because users are just busy anyways. And it's like, yeah, just hit the go button. You're done here. Easy. Okay. So that's the speed. How do we deal with complexity? Well, that's a whole different ball game, right? Because if I say make a repricer better, a lot of what's going to happen is you're going to take rule based and you're going to you got three levers you can manipulate. You can add a setting, remove a setting, or change the definition of a setting that already exists. Either one of those three will break your strategy, because all your settings relate to one another. So if I try to make it better, I break it and you hate me. So I can't do that. So it doesn't work. And by the way, your rule-based strategies have anywhere from what, 15 to 30 settings per strategy that you, the end user, have to understand, hope you get right, and all these good things. Oh, and by the way, if you start to add too many scenarios, you start to negate the original scenarios. This is a problem, right? And we call them strategies. What they really are algorithms. We just call them strategies because algorithms are a little too icky for non-technical people, which is understandable. So we call them something a little bit more friendly. So, okay, adding strategies is not really, or changing and manipulating the strategies themselves is not really a good approach. But again, first principles, you have to take a step back and say, what's the problem here? Well, the problem is not more settings and more strategies that are predefined. The problem is the fact that things change rapidly. Your rule-based strategies are very fixed. You say, here's the criteria, do that always. But the reality is how things change in real time, that doesn't work. So you're only capturing, what, 40, 60% of the scenarios? Well, that's not really good enough. So what if we take a step back here? This is what engineers love to do. They go, actually, let's take a step back and let's build something that can understand that. So that's what we did. We said, actually, it's not a strategy problem. It's a model problem. Because in reality, if you say, Dylan, what's the go-to strategy you recommend? My actual answer is every one of your SKUs should have a strategy designed for it, and it should change moment by moment. Good luck. Can't do it. So strategy is not going to work. You don't need 15 AI strategies. What you need is a model that does some very important things. First, we need to define success. Anytime you're talking about AI, if somebody can't tell you how they define and measure success, it's malarkey, for lack of a better term right now, because it's late. A lot of times when we try to define and measure success in repricing, we say my sales went up, or my buy box ownership percentage went up. Okay, is that good? No, because I can hack both those. By the way, if I lower your prices by 20%, I guarantee you both those will go up. Are you happy? Not really. So we need to take a more nuanced approach as to how we define success. And so we actually said, well, what if we could calculate like the ideal price, like where things should be? And so we did. We actually created a calculation. We call it the optimal price. It's an actual value. And it changes, by the way, moment to moment, factors in a lot of things. And so what's cool about this, though, is most of the time, the optimal price is higher than the buy box, which makes sense, because what happens in economics with a lot of competition, you press down, you add a lot of downward pressure to your price. Hence why the buy box price tends to be lower than the optimal price. But what's interesting is, what if you could release an escape hatch for that pressure? Could you raise your price and get sales higher? Yeah, turns out you can. So we measure success by how often are you, and ideally you and the buy box, at the optimal price. And the optimal price changes, right? A toy in Q1 has a very different optimal price than that same toy in Q4. And this is so important. When I say things fluctuate, I don't just mean the macro, like Q1 versus Q4. I mean intraday. A lot of times they do change. We know where we want to go. But how do we know where the heck we're at, right? Like, that's kind of the other half of the story here. This is where game theory actually comes into play, because it makes a ton of sense. I really, when you start talking AI, it's a very, very, very broad term. like ridiculously broad. It's annoying. You know, machine learning is another term that gets thrown around in the AI world because it's been the most kind of usable for the most part. It's really like predictive. I think machine learning makes a lot of sense if you're doing price optimization for like a specific brand. But for what we do, it actually doesn't make sense. There's too many variables and things change too rapidly. You can't look at historical data and just predict the future. It doesn't work. You can't hold that many things constant. But game theory actually makes a ton of sense. Because if you think about it, we're playing for a game. There's a clear way to win or not win. It's just an infinite game. Game theory sounds so hardcore, but we can actually simplify it. Game theory is just like in the optimal world, and I'm going to simplify the crap out of it. So we're not going to cover Nash equilibriums and all this crazy nonsense. Game theory strategy is just if you and I are going to compete, we're going to take turns and I have to go first, but I don't know what you're going to do. I'm going to match you. So I'm going to be cooperative with you until you're uncooperative with me. So we can forever just cooperate in the world of repricing. We just keep matching each other. If we're both happy, we're good. The moment you become uncooperative, I will also become uncooperative. By the way, that's such a simple algorithm. That's actually not that complex. So it's less about the algorithm and more the framework of how we think about this. So here's how we implement this. We study every one of your competitors, and we actually will intentionally forget how they behave so we can relearn it, because every one of your competitors, just like you, is in the different phase of the same life cycle. When you first come into stock, you're very conservative with your pricing because you want profitability. You have nothing to lose. As time goes on, long-term storage fees become a thing. Opportunity cost becomes a thing. So you become more aggressive. Every one of your competition is in a different slice of that same life cycle. So what happens when we can understand where everybody's at and how it's changed, right? Just because you're matching me today doesn't mean you're going to match me in 2 weeks. So we use the game theory framework or model concept, if you will, to understand who's doing what. And then what do I need to do to beat you? Because some sellers, I can match you, pull the buy box and we're fine. For others, I might actually have to be 5 cents below you. We'll test these things. We'll actually run experiments to understand what is true. We'll store that. We call that AI memory. We have listening memory and AI memory. Okay, so if we know where we want to go and we know what's true, I can now decide based on these things, what behaviors to utilize to close the gap. This is why, and I just saw another one before we jumped into here, why people are seeing sales above the buy box with Aura. Remember that pressure release I was talking about? This is exactly how you do that. And so what's so nice about this is I mentioned that rule-based strategies have, what, 15 to 30 settings? Maven has one. How do you want to set your min prices? That's it. And ideally, you're doing that based on ROI, right? Like you're importing your costs. We got 3 integrations now. We just added 2 in the last like 2 weeks. You're automatically setting those using ROI, profit margin, you know, fixed profit, whatever makes sense for you. And even the max price is dynamic because there's no good way to set this. I love when people are like, what's a good equation to manually set this? I'm like, there is none. You either set it too low or too high, period. Because you don't have access to the data set that we have via the API. And by the way, it should change again, moment by moment. So we recalculate this on the fly, meaning every time a price change comes in, we recalculate to see if that's still correct. Because if we saw that the buy box got suppressed at 45, shouldn't we factor that in? Yeah, but what happens in 2 weeks when the buy box is at 45 and a half? Should we change? Yeah, you're darn right we should change. And so we take all this complex nonsense and we say, hey, all you got to do, create the strategy, tell us how you want to do your min prices, we'll take care of everything else. So complexity, there's a lot of it. But as the end user, the thing that gets me really excited is that we're designing the interface, so how you're interacting with these things, to be as simplistic as possible. So you're getting to handle far more complexities by doing less as the end user. That's so important. And when I say we have good product, that's really what I'm talking about here.
Yeah, what you just said on there, taking away the complexity, I think it's so important to anchor on that. That comes with being customer and product focused with it. So As if someone's coming in that wants to look at Aura for the first time and they want to take it for a test drive and understand the different capabilities, what are some things that a new user of Aura or a new seller in the Amazon community should be thinking about as they're looking at a repricer?
Yeah, there's a few things. One, the team behind it. I always come back to the team behind it because just because a company has been in the space for a long time doesn't mean that they operate well. There's plenty of our competitors that have been here for a while that have horrible reputations, but hey, new users that don't know about that learn the hard way. And that's frustrating. So I think you should understand the team behind it. Do they actually care, or are they actually dorks like we are? I think there is something to be said about a bunch of dorks in a tech company. That's kind of important, right? So one, that matters, because how are you going to get supported, right? I don't care how easy you make a product, you're still going to have questions. And it's going to be easy for you to get those questions answered. So go test all the companies. Go actually ask their live chat, hey, I have a question here. Time them. How good was the quality of the response? Did they actually understand what you were saying, or did they throw you, did they just lob you like a template, right? So I think that's important. Number two is going to be cost, right? For us, we've really tried to work on accessibility in two different ways. One, making cutting edge tech like this AI available to every tier. So it's not just, you know, previously this was only available on anything kind of similar to what we have, although what we have is unique. AI has really been segmented for more premium pricing per month, which, okay, sure, but like, how does that help the average seller? It really doesn't. So for us, we said, we don't care how much you pay us, you get access to Maven, Hyperdrive, just different usages of it, different limitations. So that's one thing. And then cost is another. You know, we had a lot of sellers that are like, hey, I want to use you, but 97 as a starting price is just too much. I'm like, yeah, I agree. So we looked at our data. We said, okay, well, what sellers, you know, struggle to stay with us? Which ones churn the most, leave us the most? Well, turned out those doing less than 10K a month. So we said, okay, well, I know exactly why every person leaves us. So let's go look at the data. Oh, they're all leaving us because it's too expensive. Okay, let's fix that. So as a startup company ourselves, we always get access to these startup programs for software we use. You know, some things cost us $5,000 a month, but getting started, they're like, you don't have that. So we'll, you know, give us $500 a month for 6 months and then you scale up. Okay, sounds great. What if we did that for sellers? So we launched the early stage program for anybody doing less than 10 grand a month. That's the only qualification, 10 grand or less a month. And for up to 12 months, $27 a month. You get instant repricing, mobile, we'll onboard you. We'll talk about that too. That's another thing I'm going to talk about. Maven, Hyperdrive, like all the features that users are paying like hundreds of dollars for, you still get access to those things. And that's up to 12 months because I don't want you to feel like there's this time pressure to figure out the business. It's going to take you some time. I've done it. Trust me. It's probably going to take a year. That's fine. You know, there's no rush to figure this thing out in like, you know, 30, 60, 90 days. Now, what happens after 12 months? If you're still under 10K, well, then you go to 97. We gave you a year. Come on. But we'll help you out, obviously. Now, what happens if you outgrow the 10K in the 12 months? Well, that's actually really awesome because we'll give you a 50% discount on the first 3 months of whatever tier you grow into. So we can really like smooth out this cost curve for a lot of sellers. So I think looking at pricing, but don't just look at who's the cheapest, look at the best deal. I think that's so important. I never want to be the cheapest and I don't want to be the most expensive. I want to be the best ROI. And that's really hard to do. That's really been our focus through and through. So, you know, look at that thing, but also I do think onboarding matters here, right? As great as and as easy as we can make the product, some people just need to have a conversation and be sure. I'm a visual person. So yeah, I can jump in and figure it out myself, but that's not everyone. So we've designed our customer support and success team to where, and really the whole platform, if you will, to where you can jump in, never talk to us and crush it and do awesome for 10 something years. But some people need to jump in and have a ton of questions and they need to wrap their head around it. Perfect. Schedule an onboarding session. We don't charge for it. It's like 20-ish minutes. And I'll take you from literally overwhelmed and confused to feeling like a superhuman and you're actively repricing. Like Pete, you recently went through this. Like I'm not going to, our team's not going to check how much you pay us. I could care less. You jump into support and say, I would like to get an onboarding session. We said, great. Here's our calendar. Schedule it. We got you covered. I don't care how much you pay. Honestly, you could, what's so nice is you can jump in. We have an ungated trial, ungated meaning we don't ask for a credit card for 14 days. Jump in. Don't even give me a payment method. Ask for an onboarding session. And what happens, by the way, if we can't get you for a week? I'll reset your trial. Don't worry about it. You're going to get the full 14 no matter what. Like, we're not going to hold you back. Like, oh, well, sorry, that's on you. Like, no, like we got you covered there.
So I have a very basic question and I'm curious, okay. When is the right time based on the data set that you have in front of you for the new seller that just starting, maybe they have 5 to 10 SKUs. When is the time to get a repricer?
If we took money out of the equation, it's immediate because there's nothing but upside, right? Now, even with early stage, it still costs $27 a month. So that is something. What I would say, it's less about a number anymore because it really just depends. What I've been recommending lately with early stage is as long as you're able to consistently send inventory in, like even just trickling in, but you got that kind of process moving, you should consider it. Because what a lot of people don't realize is a lot of people think you get repricing tools. This is another misconception. When you're large. No. You get a repricing tool and that's how you grow, right? Like even with legacy, we were increasing sales. If you're coming to us without using a repricing tool, we were increasing sales on average 40 to 60%. There's some variance there. If you're coming to us from another tool, it was 20 to 40% increase in sales. Imagine how that compounds over time. Now that's legacy. That's not even the new stuff, right? Like that's the old, outdated, old system. So I haven't looked at the math on 1.0, but I can tell you it's dramatically better. And so it's one of those things that as early as you can afford it, you should consider it. I used to say, you know, hey, $5,000 a month, you know, 50 SKUs, but that's only because it costs $97 to get started. And you kind of needed to have the cash flow baked in to afford it. $27, it's not that big of a deal anymore.
Yeah. Like I agree with you. I think that what I used to say, oh, blanket number, like maybe it's this, yeah. Maybe it's that. Right. No, it's perfect. Right. But yeah. Now what I've kind of transitioned to is when you emotionally know that you're going to commit to this, yeah. You're going to follow through, you're going to be sourcing, you're going to be finding products, you're going to learn the skill.
Yeah.
That is going to allow you, like you said, to compound so much faster and start mm-hmm. churning inventory. Like when I hopped over to Aura, my sales doubled, like for content.
That's so awesome.
Now I
love it.
Like, I owe response.
You said that and I thought you were joking. And then you sent me a screenshot. Yeah. I was like, oh dang, let's go.
Yeah, no, I sent it. Now, partially because I'm a very lazy repricer, admittedly. Right. And I get flack right. for it. But Aura is so easy that it was like, oh, and Nick's been giving me flack about not moving over for months.
Love it.
Months. Like been hearing it for months. And I was like, I don't know if I want to. It's yeah. a lot of work. Turns out yeah. it's not a ton of work. I was in fact late to my onboarding because I'd already figured it out. So
another thing, by the way, to yeah. consider when do you decide? The reason why I like to bring up like we have an ungated trial, like where we don't ask for a credit card. What's cool about that is like you can jump in and see if it has an effect. You'll know very quickly if it's too soon because like nothing will happen, right? Like if you got like right. 5 SKUs, it's hard to see anything in the data. So what's cool about that is go through a full 2-week trial, and if you see positive results, great, stay with it. If you don't, cool, cancel. Don't worry about it, right? Come back later. You know, I don't need your money now. I want you to be with us for a long period of time. So if now it's not great, awesome, wait. So you'll know, and even with early stage, you know, I say it's up to 12 months. That's not a commitment. We're not asking you for 12 months commitment. You could get month 3, be like, yeah, just, you know, this was a cool thing I was testing out, but like, I'm good here. I'm shutting down the Amazon business. Great, cancel. Don't worry about it. You know, so you're not committing necessarily a ton here month to month. And actually, we don't even do annuals for the early stage. We only do monthly.
What features do you think don't get enough attention in the repricing space?
You know, funny enough is mobile. I know it sounds so boring, but like I'll show you like an actual demo account here real quick. So like Aura works on mobile. We don't have a downloadable app. We have what's called a progressive web app, a PWA. All that means is like you log in on your browser and you add it to your home screen. It acts the exact same. So like this is a live account. Got support down here, everything. I do like that it says good evening because it knows your browser's timeline or time zone. So if it's in the morning, it'll say good morning. I love that feature. It's a little Easter egg. I bring that up because I see so many people on Twitter X. I'm still going to keep calling it Twitter. I don't care. That are like posting pictures on their laptop in their car doing sourcing. Like, I'm updating my pricing. I'm like, that sounds horrible. Like, what are you doing? Like, your phone's already in your right hand when you're sourcing. So like, just pull up Aura and do what you need to. But it's not just that. It's like, there's so many situations where you realize that you're like at your kid's football game. You're like, oh crap, I forgot to do that. Well, now you got to create a task for yourself. And most people don't have task managers in the Amazon space. They're like, I'll remember that. Like, no, you're not. Right. And so like so many things don't get done. And it's like, well, what if it took you 5 seconds to do that on your phone? problem solved, right? So like, I think that actually is very beneficial. We track usage based on platforms. Mobile's huge. Mobile's way larger than we thought. And this is so important why when we were rebuilding, we surveyed hundreds of our users, like a small segment of our users, just to understand how did they utilize it. And another thing is auto refresh. So we would talk to users, and I think Nick, we actually talked to you about this. Like, how often per day are you pulling up Aura? And a lot of people were like, I don't put it down. Like, it's just always on a tab and I refresh it. I'm like, oh, that's cool. But then we started to think, well, hold on. We want things to be as real time as possible. If you loaded that page 15 minutes ago, switch tabs and came back over and then try to make a decision on the data you're seeing, that data is 15 minutes old. So what if we could, and we love dashboards, like in the Boston office, we have a grid of four mounted displays, like TV displays of dashboard data. Like, everybody could see the revenue, everything. And we're like, oh, that's cool. People are basically using Aura like a dashboard. So what if we created that? And so there's four pages that do this. You can toggle it on like the dashboard, the specific listing page. You toggle this on every 5 seconds, or is checking for data, updated data in our system that you're not seeing. And we'll just push it. You're not seeing the page reload. You're just seeing the data change in real time. Like, why does that matter? Well, I don't want you making outdated decisions. Most of the time you're looking at your repricing tool to either make a change that you already know or go analyze things to potentially make a change. And unfortunately, 15 minute old data is outdated in today's world. And that's going to consistently get, you know, faster and faster. Again, speed is one of those two things I mentioned. So I think getting data as real time as possible and accessible wherever actually matters. Like, I joke that Aura's one of the few repricing tools that works anywhere. I can reprice in my Model 3 Tesla. I got this Rabbit R1 AI thing that I'm going to for sure make Aura work on it once they open it up for me. You know, like, we will make Aura work anywhere. And I think it should. You know, why not? So for me, it's like, it's less about like the specific features. I think we've done a good job there, but it's how do you make those things as accessible and easy to use as possible? And like, again, change the standard. I'm over the slow loading data pages. Like, it's ridiculous at this point. So that's one thing. And then just good design, man. You know, it goes hopefully without saying, but we're probably one of the few software companies that actually has a designer full-time on staff, like six figures, like Tasso crushes it. And his whole job is to make the product look amazing and be easy as hell to use. That's his whole job. And so the reason why we hear the term intuitive a lot from our users is because it's built to be intuitive as much as possible. And so I think if you could design a heavily technical tool like what we've built, like, our software is incredibly complex under the hood, but not make it feel that way to the end user, that's a good thing. And so for me, I think that is actually undervalued is good design, but you know it when you feel it. You know what I mean? Like, go compare us to some of our competitors from an actual like usage perspective, and like you'll feel the difference.
Yeah, I noticed that pretty early with just like the simplicity. Like, if I have four or five strategies that I'm going to use with my products, I can go apply those very quickly. I don't have to mess around in the min-max column. I can be walking my dog. I can do these like 15 minutes and move on with my life. I hate repricing. It's literally the worst thing to do. So make it easy.
So I want to use that I hate repricing, so I used Aura. Like, that's what, you know what I mean? But that's literally what we think about. It's like, I get it. Nobody geeks out with repricing like we do. Like, it's not as cool to everybody as it is to us, but like, how do we, like, you still need to get the value from it. So how do we design it in such a way that you're like, yeah, I hate it, but it works really well. And it's easy as crap to use and doesn't take up more of my time. That's the whole point.
Dylan, you hit on a lot of the key features, and now you got us wanting more as customers. So talk a little bit. I know you've been very active on the timeline with some new partnerships and some new features are there. So is there any ones that you want to highlight, any teasers you can give us? Just kind of talk about what's the roadmap look
like? It's ever growing. That's for sure. Funny enough, dark mode gets asked for so much. We did some early testing on dark mode. We're not done with it, but we are working on dark mode. So that's definitely coming. Funny enough, people want that more than we thought. We thought that was just for us. Another thing is like the command palette. So like command K, like I use linear, we use superhuman. Like, I'm used to like hitting command K and type out and do this thing. So I really like this concept of making Aura very keyboard led. So, you know, I could say /, go to, you know, my Yeti listing, hit command K, enable repricing, hit enter. And like, it does it. Like, I don't want to have to touch my mouse. Those little things do actually add up quite a bit. You know, those are kind of smaller quality of life things, but on the grander scale, like going to all 20 marketplaces, we're set up to do it, especially from a currency perspective. But man, those translation of reports and feeds are just insane. So that's something you can't rush, unfortunately. We try to rush that for the 1.0 release, but we're just like, it's going to be way too risky to rush that. So we're going to hold back on that until we can do it right. So I think going to all 20 marketplaces is going to be huge for us, as well as Walmart is becoming more and more of a conversation. It's a very evergreen world, or a green world, should I say, right now, like open landscape. So it's hard to just say that you can port over what we know from Amazon to Walmart. I don't think that's the right analogy, because you're starting to see some Amazon or some Walmart repricing tools pop up. But I'm not fully confident that they are approaching it from first principles and looking at the actual data to make the right optimal decisions. That becomes kind of a concern. So that's one area we're definitely looking at. Yeah, more integrations. You know, for us, we realized that, and I've said this for years, that the Amazon industry has been very secretive in the sense of, like, we don't share things, we don't talk to one another, and we just kind of got sick of that. And especially seeing the younger generation kind of transition. Like, when I was a seller, we had Facebook groups. You didn't share things, you didn't source together, but like, you guys are like legit jumping on Zoom calls and sourcing together. Like, this is ridiculous, but it's amazing, right? It makes so much sense. And so we started to reach out to other software companies, be like, hey, can we integrate? Can we just partner? Like, let's just, like, us combining, even if we cannot integrate, is a good thing. Like, we should have deep relationships. We should know one another. We should be able to lean on one another and create this, you know, ecosystem of amazing modern software with founders who care, who give a crap, right? Like I know at ScanPower, I know Paul Rutherford now, like one of the founders. And I'm like, I just like can text him. Like, there is something about, and I've seen his passion. We've talked offline. I'm like, this dude actually cares about what he's doing, like we do. And not every company is that way in our space. And so, you know, going deeper into integration, so there's more options, more flexibility, things like that. So our customers are not locked into one type of integration, I think is super important. But deeper partnerships too, man. Like, you know, there's a lot. We're starting to go to more, this is not really product related, but we're starting to go to more of these in-person events, like getting even deeper and closer to the community, I think makes a ton of sense. I kind of crashed Miami Seller Conference last minute, but we'll be at Proven Conference this month, and we'll be at AMZ United in August. We'll be speaking there. We'll be sponsoring and stuff. You know, so there's a lot of things I can't necessarily share because we're kind of stealth mode. Nick, you know which one I'm talking about that I can't share because mm-hmm. I've let you beta test. Not beta test. I asked you a barrage of questions for user testing. But needless to say, there is a lot on the product side coming that I cannot talk about, but there is a lot of good stuff coming everyone's way is what I will say. I know it's like a cop out there, but some things I can share, some things I can't. I'll put it that way.
Well, there's the teaser right there, right?
Yeah. 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 And Nick's just like, I know what it is.
I love it. I mean, I've seen just since I've been on the platform, a lot of new cool things coming our way.
Yep.
And I know I love the excitement. I mean, that's,
yeah.
And when you're partnering with someone, that's really, really cool to see. And when you're consuming someone's software, you're basically partners. And if your partner's really advocating for you, that's what I've seen so far. So
yeah,
that is super cool. But as we wrap up, we've talked about a lot of stuff related to software repricing. Is there anything we missed? I like to just kind of give the floor before we wrap up. Anything we want to leave the folks with before we wrap?
You know, less on the repricing side, but it does kind of come back to kind of how we're viewing the world from a software perspective, right? Like, a lot of things changing. The hype cycle of AI is starting to change in the sense, like, it's becoming applicable. There's still, like, you know, I get this R1 that I pre-ordered, and like, it's cool, but like, it's totally a beta and like has so many problems, right? Like, but I geek out with a lot of this stuff because I think this is where the world is going. I don't necessarily in the next 2 to 3 years believe that everything just fundamentally changes, like nobody has a job kind of crap. But as sellers, I do believe in my own testing with building like AI agents and stuff like that. Most of what your VAs are doing right now will change. Most of what your Amazon agencies do right now will go away because the cost of you spinning up your own agent, very negligible. Are they at a point where it's fully reliable? No, but they're getting there really fast. And I don't think people understand like actually how short, how little months it's been since ChatGPT came out, like GPT 3.5, which was garbage, and like how fast things are accelerating. People don't understand the difference between a linear versus an exponential growth curve. And we're talking about tech here, so it's going to be exponential. So if you think about what your VAs do, they analyze data, make certain decisions that are really, really like not that complicated, right? Like they're working off checklists, which is kind of how we started this conversation, that you clearly define. And they move information around either locally on their computer or on the internet. Turns out AI agents are really good at doing this. And I think we do get to a point where most of what your VAs are doing, if not all of them, and what any agents are doing, you know, agencies are doing, like PPC advertising optimization, stuff like that, will go to agents, either off the shelf things you're paying for or something you're building yourself. So I think, not that you need to become an engineer and like study this, not at all what I'm saying, but I think you should be keeping tabs on how things are changing so you can be aware of what the competitive advantages will be in the next 6 to 12 to 18 months, because it's not capital. That's going to be the competitive advantage that used to be the case. That is no longer the case, in my opinion. Getting access to capital is not that difficult, especially if you're going the credit card route. Time's not really a competitive advantage anymore. It's going to come down to capacity. It's going to come down like how fast can you deploy that capital and how great can you deploy that capital. Turns out if you could do that with software for pennies on the hour, you're going to do pretty well. So, you know, again, not saying that you should, you know, fundamentally change everything, but I think you should be looking at these things. You know, I wrote a blog post on the modern financial stack for a seller, and like all those things integrate really well. And I see a lot of people even using software that don't even integrate. This has nothing to do with AI. They're just literally choosing tools that don't even talk to one another. And I'm like, this is a subset of the problem I'm talking about here, which is like you're making life harder and not utilizing technology to its fullest potential. But eventually we will get to a point where AI agents will be able to source for you 24/7 for probably dollars per hour, if not pennies. We're getting there very fast. I was able to do this with off-the-shelf tooling one time. It took hours and was not great, but it found one profitable SKU doing OA with an agent. And this was like 6 months ago. Mm-hmm. And I'm not a software engineer. So like it's feasible. We're getting there. So, you know, I'm a Trekkie, so I'm eternally optimistic about tech. So I say all these things to like, be like, this is awesome. Like, see what's coming, see what the future of being an Amazon e-commerce brand owner is. It's going to get really fun, really fast, but you got to look at these things. And this is why I test things like this, just to see where are we at right now, what's possible. Because honestly, I want to be able to press this little button. It's like a little walkie-talkie thing. I want to hold this button down. I want to train it to use Aura. I want to say, add Hyperdrive to all my Nike listings, and it goes, cool, I know how to do that, and it just goes and does it for me. Like, mm-hmm. Honestly, I want to get to a point where you don't even have to log into Aura. You just say what you want and it just goes, cool, I'll do that for you. Like, we're getting there very fast. So yeah, I'll leave it with that.
Well, Dylan, thank you for coming on. It's been a great conversation, and I appreciate it. The context that you've given everybody about the tool, about yourself, and we look forward to having you on again.
Yeah, I appreciate you guys having me on. I'm glad we finally got you over. I'm glad Nick finally beat you down enough to get you over. So that's always good. I appreciate that, Nick. Listen, guys, I love the conversation. I appreciate, you know, you giving us lending your platform to us to be able to have this conversation and kind of share our passion about what we do. If anybody has any questions, you can again email me directly, Dylan@goora.com. I'm easily accessible. You can reach out to the support team, of course. Early stage is there. It's available for anybody who needs it, for anybody who qualifies for it. But yeah, we're super pumped about what we're working on and what comes next.
Cool. Well, with that, we will see you next time to the audience.
Thanks, guys.